It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about, impeachment on the table, hearing another hearing day, day two. Over the weekend, the Teamsters had their big presidential forum. Going to talk a little bit about that. Some craziness out of Ohio, along with a Supreme Court case that, well, not going to be heard, which means, hey, more chaos coming. Yay. Lots of fun. But wanted to start off with this Voice of America article that I came across pointing out the second annual Reagan National Defense Survey. This is one of the scary things. You know, all the other stuff in D.C., all the Trump stuff aside, the scary thing to me is the fact that the Russians, Vladimir Putin and his army of disinformation folks, are actually, they're succeeding. And what this second annual Reagan National Defense Survey found out, completed back in October, what they found out is 46% of our military households view Russia as an ally. Almost half of military families view Russia as an ally. And you know, as I'm thinking about this, I'm going, you know, aren't we actually preparing all the time for, you know, conflict where the Russians are involved? Obviously, the Chinese are our big threat, but the Russians are right there. Now, overall in society, 28% of Americans identified Russia as an ally, which is just bizarre to me. Now, that's up from last year, which was 19%. So to me, what's going on here, and this is, and I was just having this conversation today with my Tea Party dentist, who was asking, you know, well, how do you see things playing out? And I said, look, I'm really kind of nervous. I'm really kind of worried of where we are going as a country because we don't have substantive discussions anymore. We are in a camp on the right or the left. We're in our camps. We're in our silos. And whatever that silo has taken on tends to be our beliefs. And I said, look, I don't have really any more friends who you can have just a simple discussion with. You know, where you could talk about issues and you may disagree, but you walk away going, yeah, that was worth my time. What I find now is most people that I talk to, it's yelling talking points and platitudes at each other. You know, my side, I believe, mine, I, you know, that whole thing. This is, to me, one of those things where, you know, when I was a kid, everyone agreed the Russians were a threat. And look, I remember the, you know, the Cold War, and I remember, you know, the practicing, you know, hey, the bombs could fall. There could be nuclear winter. There could be MAD. Remember MAD, mutually assured destruction, if we ever got into a conflict. So now you've got 46%, according to this Reagan. And now this isn't a hippie liberal poll. This isn't a hippie liberal group. This is the Ronald Reagan National Defense Survey. Saying 46% of military households now view Russia as an ally. Now, overall, the majority of the country, 71% of all Americans and 53% of military households still view Russia as an enemy. Even though there's been a, you know, the spike in pro-Russian sentiment, there's still, you know, there's still a good majority of us. But according to this report, Pentagon officials are freaking out because they're not quite sure. Hold on, if we end up getting into conflict with the Russians, wait, do we end up getting a bunch of sympathizers? Now, according to the VOA Voice of America article, this Defense Department spokesperson, Lieutenant Colonel Carla Gleason, told them that there's an effort on the part of Russia to flood the media with disinformation and sow doubt and confusion. That's exactly what we've been saying from the very beginning of the Trump presidency. The Russians did this very clearly, without question. Very simple. It's not hard. She went on to say that this is not only through discordant and inflammatory dialogue, but also through fake narratives designed to elicit sympathetic views. We are actively working to expose and counter Russian disinformation wherever possible. Now, remember, we're being told by Donald Trump and the Republicans, it wasn't the Russians who meddled in the 2016 election. No, no. It was actually Ukraine. You know, the country who's being invaded by Russian separatists. You know, the country that is trying to fight off, you know, the Russians taking them over. Because, well, they did annex Crimea. I shouldn't say annex. That's such a nice word. They marched in and took it. And the rest of the world said, okay. President Obama, too, boogered this up. Okay. Do you think Trump would have done anything? No, he used to take the rest of the country, I believe. Now, what's interesting is, you know, and this has been, you know, a very Trumpian thing, because Trump from the beginning said, you know, well, what's the big deal if we don't have a good relationship? I want to have a good relationship with Russia, even though they're meddling in our elections, even though they've got, you know, the USSR ambitions, you know, taking back, getting the old gang back together. He's still on that you know, we should have good relations. And I don't think we should be at each other's throats, but at an arm's length. There was a Pew survey back in September of 18 that pointed out 35% of Americans wanted more cooperation with Russia. And this is, again, part of the Trump effect. And, you know, what's scary to me is, you know, here we have these influence campaigns going on. We have, and look, the military knows this. You know, you have U.S. defense and security officials who, according to this VOA report, is saying, look, Russia's been targeting U.S. military personnel since, you know, in their mind, since 2017 in preparation for the 2018 election. They said, quote, Russia's goal, they said, was not so much to swing the results of the election, but to seed U.S. military personnel with the right type of disinformation so that they would be predisposed to view Russia and its actions in a more favorable way in the future. So when they do take over the Ukraine, you know, they're corrupt. They're bad. They're horrible. You know, they had Hunter Biden. So when Russia goes in and says, yeah, we're going to take it over, there's going to be people in this country who go, wow, we're going to clear up that corruption, which is insane to me. But this is where we are. And what's interesting is you've got these officials who are saying, you know, countering this kind of disinformation campaign is incredibly difficult. And it's a nice way of saying the American people are freaking stupid. I mean, and I hate putting it that blatantly, but I've seen people literally wearing things, quotes that people never said. I literally have people telling me things that never happened because they saw it on a meme. It was printed on a T-shirt, so it's got to be accurate. I saw it on the internet. And, you know, it's kind of scary. And, you know, you look at the new polling that's out, and you've got in the Republican Party significant changes. Now, remember, this is the party of Reagan. This is the party of national defense. This is the party of strong military. I would argue the party of fascism, buying into the fascist argument, which is softening their views on Russia because of Trump, and ultimately turning against, well, us. And the thing is our national defense strategy, you know, all of the smart people who do the war stuff, which was just updated 2 years ago, puts the Chinese as our biggest adversary, our biggest threat, the Chinese. And second, the Chinese are 28%, you know, biggest. The second, Russia. And it got me thinking that, you remember, you know, when Mitt Romney was running in 12 and he was saying Russia's our biggest threat and everybody mocked him? This is what he was talking about. Because there was this stuff was beginning then. So when I look at this, and I look at the disinformation campaign that's going on, and I look at what the Russians are doing very successfully, because they're smart, They know our divisions, they know our fault lines, and they know how to just tweak those little things. And look, they've got an asset in the White House. They've got a president who is spewing their talking points. So you put that on one side, and then you, on the other side, add to this the NPR story I came across over the weekend that talked about a new study out of Stanford. According to Stanford researchers who were testing kids' ability to find fake news, they evaluated these students' ability to assess information in front of them, the kind of sources that were in front of them, and then to describe, you know, what they were finding. The report says that the researchers found the results dismaying, bleak, and a threat to democracy because these kids couldn't do it and didn't do it. And I would argue as a society, we're not doing it because we keep believing the headline because we don't actually read the story. And I go to today. Today's a big day because the Inspector General came out with their report on the Russia probe on the FBI, and the headline, you know, just the first headline, FBI wiretap of Trump campaign aide was riddled with errors. That's the headline. And you go through and you read the article, and yeah, there were errors. But what they also found is it was credible to go after this, and it was credible. It was a credible threat. They found they're there, but the headline didn't say that. The headline just said, bad FBI, bad. But when you get into the article, which said, look, you know, there was significant stuff going on there. There were reasons to investigate this. Now, did they cut corners? Sure. They always do, and that should be held accountable. But to, as all of the right-wing groups today sent me in their emails, that it's all a hoax, it's all, you know, the FBI, you know, was against Donald Trump, and the FBI were in the pockets of Hillary Clinton and all this, which is just mind-blowingly ignorant, because just stop and think about it on a simple plan. The FBI, the organization of J. Edgar Hoover on the side of liberals. I mean, I almost can't imagine how that thought would ever get into someone's mind. I think of the FBI as, you know, these clean-cut, highly conservative, highly law-and-order, iron-fisted types. But ultimately patriotic. Who saw this guy running for president and said, uh-oh, this is bad for the country. They still the ones who are able to look through the fake news. They still the ones able to go, the Russians are involved in all this. And I looked to right here where I'm at in central Pennsylvania. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania was the place of the first little Russian troll. Guy named Melvin Reddick. Melvin Reddick isn't an actual human being. Melvin Reddick is an online construct. A troll. But Melvin passed on all kinds of memes and started all kinds of rallies and all kinds of stuff. He was all over the place. Didn't exist other than a couple of people in a building in St. Petersburg who were, well, manipulating the people around him. It's crazy. So I look at all of this stuff, and look, the impeachment hearings and all this stuff that's going on is the result of us not being able to decipher what is real and what isn't. And this is what the 2020 election, you know, all this other stuff aside, this is something we've got to figure out and become more fact-based human beings as opposed to, oh, I saw it on a t-shirt, got to be true. This election is the most important in our country's history. And we've got to get it right. Look, if you're a Trump supporter and you've got a reason why, bless you. Good for you. But at least let it be an actual reason, not something that a Russian troll planted in your head. And I know, nobody told me how to vote. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you keep believing that. Again, our arrogance, our bravado, exactly what they use against us. Anyway, lots to get to talk about today. When we come back, the Teamsters had their presidential forum in Iowa. We're going to get Jesse Case to come talk with the Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 238 to give us some thoughts on the day's events and, you know, maybe where the IBT goes forward. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2008. That was the day UE Local 1110 members at Republic Windows in Chicago began a five-day occupation to protest the imminent closure of their plant. A month earlier, Republic workers witnessed management moving machinery out of the factory. They began monitoring where the machinery was going and soon learned it was headed for a new non-union plant in Iowa. They planned a possible plant occupation. By December 2nd, management announced the plant was closing in just 3 days. Republic Windows owner Richard Gelman blamed Bank of America for refusing to extend credit just as the federal government had bailed out the banks in a $700 billion deal. Workers learned they would receive no severance or vacation pay despite WARN Act mandates. The next day, they rallied out in front of Bank of America chanting, "You got bailed out, we got sold out." Workers were determined to occupy the plant that Friday when they went to pick up their last paychecks. Police refused to remove the sit-downers, and the occupation quickly made national news. Local labor leaders and trade unionists, activists, and politicians all visited strikers and lent their support. Journalist Carrie Leiterson recounts the events in her book, Revolt on Goose Island, noting the donations of food, blankets, pillows, sleeping bags, and other necessities that poured into the factory. Protests of Bank of America spread across the country. By the following Wednesday, workers learned that though they could not keep their plant open, they would at least win severance and vacation pay. In 2012, some of those workers reopened that plant under the name New Era Windows as a worker-run cooperative. They specialize in energy-efficient vinyl windows. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, over the weekend, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters held their presidential forum out in Iowa. You had Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar show up. Pete Buttigieg was there. You had Senator Cory Booker, billionaire Tom Steyer, Joe Biden, and obviously Bernie Sanders. And I'll tell you, you know, they all are preferable, in my view, to what we have in the White House right now, especially when you look at what this administration has done and all of the assaults on labor that we've seen over the last couple of years. So for me, any of them at this point would be an improvement. But, you know, it was an opportunity Saturday to hear, you know, how are they going to pick up the ball and move the cause of working people forward? And I was happy to see it. And it's about time that labor really put their foot down and say, look, what are you going to do to help working people in this country? And here to give us a thought of what happened on Saturday, I've asked Jesse Case to come talk with us. Jesse is the Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 238 out in the great state of Iowa. Jesse, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So give me a sense of, you know, what was the event like? I mean, there were several hundred people crammed into this room as the candidates, you know, kind of gave their what they do for labor speech.
Well, yeah, we had over 700 Teamsters from coast to coast coming to Iowa from Los Angeles and Chicago and New England. And it was a beautiful venue, Vets Memorial Coliseum, on the 78th anniversary of Pearl Harbor Day. Yeah, the reason we did it is because we need an alternative to this train wreck coming out of Washington, D.C. And a lot of the forums and debates we've seen so far have kind of looked the same. And we wanted to have a forum and a venue that that deals with the issues of working people. So that's what we put together.
No, and look, there, I've been saying for a while that, you know, we've got to have candidates who are not just gonna talk the talk, but walk the walk. And one of the things I thought that, to me, one of the most important moments was Bernie Sanders saying, look, this is what I do. This is what I've always done. And I love the shot that he threw in there. He goes, I probably walked more picket lines than everybody in the field combined.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And you know, the Teamsters have laid out criteria as a precursor to any endorsement, and it includes walking the picket line or showing up at union events, as well as a survey and a video, so they're on the record on where they stand on these issues. And really, the issues that we were focusing on were retirement security, the right to organize a union, and fair trade deals. And that, you don't hear any of the other, you know, forums or debates talking about these issues. And these are the issues that we know are important to our members. We did a nationwide survey, and these are the issues that are going to decide the 2020 election. You know, without retirement security, without fixing the multi-employer pension problem we have in this country, where we can let people retire with dignity, this country, the economy is just not going to work in the long run. Without the right to organize a union, without fixing the current laws where there's no chief, when employers violate the National Labor Relations Act, the economy is not going to run well in the long run. And without fair trade deals, where we've got protection for, you know, labor protections and language that keeps jobs in America, the economy is doomed for failure in the long run. So these are the three issues that we know are important, not only to Teamsters, but to the economy of this country in the future.
Right. You know, let's talk about the first one, pension security. You know, because I talk to a lot of my Teamster brothers and sisters, and this is front and foremost on their mind because, look, there are a couple of funds that are struggling right now. I mean, I look at the central states that are having some problems. I look at the mine workers who are having a lot of problems. We bail out these big banks all the time. Anytime Wall Street gets themselves into trouble, you've got politicians running with blank checks. But yet in this moment where there's a question of whether we're going to pay out and retirees are going to get what they paid for, it seems to be something that's been going on for, this is going back about 10 years now that we've been fighting to shore up these funds. And yet nothing's gotten done for working people.
Well, I think that's because if you follow the money, there's a clear story to tell here. You know, banks, you're absolutely right. They're too big to fail. They'll get a bailout anytime they need. The auto industry gets a bailout anytime they need. Wall Street gets bailed out anytime they need. But if you have hundreds of thousands or millions of middle income, middle class people whose retirements are going to collapse, the government's nowhere to be found, even though they're supposed to be a government of the people and for the people. And this pension reform that we're talking about is not a bailout like Wall Street got or like the banking industry got. We're talking about a low interest loan through Treasury that's guaranteed by bonds. There's over $1 trillion in low interest loans like this floating around in the economy today in the private sector. But for some reason, when it comes to working people, it's like pulling teeth to get Congress to take action. But we think, there is some movement. We've gotten it out of the House of Representatives. We're starting to see some movement in the Senate, and we're confident that in the end we'll get it done.
Well, let's hope that happens. But here's the thing. Even if you do get this through, the Butch Lewis Act pushed through, and there is some help on the short term, the long-term problem still exists that there aren't as many members as there were. There aren't as many members working as there are going to be retired. And at some point, that organizing thing has got to come back around. And for me, it's 70 years of ossified labor law. It's all of the horrible policies, not just of this administration, but of administrations past, you know, going back to Reagan, going back to Nixon. I mean, there are things that have to be fixed. And I think one of the things that I think is more, even as important as the pensions, is what are we going to do to get people to be able to join and form unions again? Because look, I've seen the polling as you have. You know, more than 60% of workers say that they'd join a union tomorrow if they could.
Well, I think we have to redefine the playing field here, and they've made it nearly impossible for workers to form a union. They've told us and they've trained us. You know, if you sign an interest card, if you don't get fired, if you alienate your employer, if you get an election, if you win that election, if you get a first contract, then you get to join a union. and they put up so many hoops and obstacles to jump through. It's almost impossible. And what we need to do is go back to where we were 100 years ago, before there were laws, because they're really trying to legislate unions out of existence right now. But, you know, we know something that they have forgotten, or maybe they never knew, which is that you cannot legislate a movement out of existence. It just doesn't work. You know, so if you look at where we were 100 years ago, before there were good labor laws, things looked very similar to where they are today. Immigration levels were very similar to today's. The difference between, you know, worker pay and robber barons is very close to where it is today. The stock market, very close to where it is today comparatively. So the conditions are very favorable. And if you go back to that period, that was the period that, you know, it was right before the largest growth in the history of the American labor movement. So I think we're optimistic. You're seeing more people organize. You're seeing more people that are militant about organizing. And I think we're going to see a renaissance in unions.
I hope so. And it's one of the things I've been calling for the last several years. Look, it's that militancy that we have to have. And, you know, as a friend of our friend of the show, Sarah Nelson, always says, you know, there are no illegal strikes. There's just unsuccessful ones. And you can legislate them out of existence. But at the end of the day, it's still about workers having the ability to fold their arms and march their feet.
Yeah, that's right. And we have to, you know, quit asking their permission to organize. You know, we don't need to be certified by the federal government to fight for workers' rights. And, you know, in Iowa, we formed the Teamsters Community Action Network, TeamCAN. It's the social justice arm, because 100 years ago, we were fighting in the streets just as much as we were fighting in the workplace. And we will always fight in the workplace. That's our core mission, bargaining contracts, servicing our members. But we also have to fight in the street. And we have to do social justice organizing in the neighborhood. You know, TeamCAN, first thing we did was we trained 400 brand new activists on basic organizing techniques. Some of those activists went on to run for office themselves or organize campaigns in their community. We formed an employee-owned temp agency that pays $15 an hour because it's very hard to organize temp workers. We're currently coordinating a network of activists in manufactured home communities who are fighting predatory business, you know, housing practices, and fighting to maintain affordable housing in our neighborhood, and so fighting in the streets and organizing in our neighborhood is just as important as organizing in the workplace.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. You know, returning the union hall to the community and being in the center of the part of the community. You're right. You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Jesse Casey, the Secretary of Treasurer of Teamsters Local 238 out in Iowa. We're talking about the presidential forum the IBT held over the weekend. So what was the general sense in the room? I mean, did you guys take a poll at the end? What's the general sense of where those folks were kind of like a focus group? We're leaning with the six candidates.
It's very interesting that the group seemed to, you know, be pretty split over all the candidates, and you know, we're not making an endorsement until we get closer to after the Iowa caucuses and maybe closer to the convention. But you know, the important thing is that Teamsters participate in the process, that they participate in their caucuses, they participate in their primaries. And, you know, we've done a great job of coordinating with Teamsters in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada to really bird dog these candidates. We follow them around the state and make sure that we're educating them on Teamster issues and asking them questions and holding them accountable state by state in a coordinated effort. So there's no getting away from us. You know, the Teamsters, 1.4 million members, were everywhere. And we had six great candidates. The audience, you know, there are factions of the audience that liked every single one of them, and that's because that every single one of them would be better than that train wreck that's currently in the White House.
Yeah, I had one of my, because obviously, you know, being a Teamster, you know that there are a number of Teamsters who are Trump supporters, and I know a bunch of them. They were curious if Donald Trump was invited to this forum.
We've invited Trump and all the candidates to participate in our process. Not every candidate was invited to this forum, but the criteria we used were, you know, front runners and people who are represented by the Teamsters Union. And then a couple of them, as you know, dropped out in the last couple of weeks. They folded their the campaigns, and we added a couple more. But if Donald Trump wants to come and talk to a group of Teamsters, he can follow the same process as the other candidates.
Right.
But the reason he hasn't filled out the survey, or maybe we could ask, somebody should ask him that. The reality is he didn't fill out the survey. If you don't fill out the survey on our issues, you don't get to participate in our forums.
Excellent.
If you don't follow the process, you don't get to participate in the forum. So he may be in the White House, but he's not going to get treated any differently than anybody else. And the only way he would get maybe treated more fairly is if he started telling the truth.
There is that. So let me ask you this, because, you know, there are, like I said, there are, at least the narrative has been that Trump won because union members went from Hillary to Donald Trump. And there's a lot of people saying we've got to get them to go back the other way. This administration has really honestly been horrible, especially for organized labor. You look at the Janus decision. There's some NLRB stuff that's really bad. The deregulation is horrible. There's a lot of stuff here. How do you make the argument to those members who you know, did make the switch for Trump, because Trump was talking about, you know, dealing with the bad trade agreements and revitalizing manufacturing, even though he's boogered those up? How do you make that argument back to them?
Well, I think, you know, there are a couple factors that were at play in 2016. One is that people were duped. You know, Donald Trump is a great liar. He misled people. He says not what he thinks, but what he thinks people want to hear. So there was a certain aspect of people wanting a change, and Trump offered himself as an alternative, but it was disguised in a bunch of lies. The other thing is, in 2016 and in the past, frankly, the Democrats have not done a great job of addressing labor's issues.
Right.
And, you know, they frankly ignored labor a lot in the past, and they keep losing elections. And I think this cycle, they're starting to wake up a little bit and say, you know what, if we're going to ask labor to save our party once again, maybe we should actually pay attention to what their issues are, because it's very hard for us to mobilize our members for people like Hillary Clinton when Hillary Clinton doesn't talk about our issues. And that's just an example, not to pick her out fully, but, you know, in the past, if you don't talk about labor issues and then you come to us and ask us to turn out our members to vote for you, you know, what are we supposed to tell them? So I think Democrats are evolving in the right direction to address labor's issues, and that's why you saw such a successful forum this weekend, is because it was a forum specifically on labor's issues, and we had great participation from the candidates and the fired up crowd at the end.
And at the end of it, the hope is no matter who you endorse, we hold accountable. Because, look, I voted for Bill Clinton for the reason that he said he was going to pass strike replacement. I voted for Barack Obama because he told me twice, looked me in the eye, shook my hand twice, and said we were going to get the Employee Free Choice Act. None of that got done. So the question then becomes, how do we, after this process, make sure that they're held accountable?
Yeah, and if you see what happens when we don't hold people accountable, or when there's no accountability going into the process. You know, in Iowa, all you have to do is look what happened when the Republicans took over the Senate. After 40 years, they got a trifecta of the governor's office, the House, and the Senate, and they immediately pivoted to creating barriers for workers' comp, and they cut funding for community colleges and universities. They took away access to cancer screenings and preventative health services, and they cut funding for mental health institutions, and they cut funding for investigations of child abuse and elderly abuse, and they took away collective bargaining rights for 180,000 public sector workers, and they reduced the minimum wage for 65,000 Iowans, and it goes on and on and on and on. And it's because there was no accountability. Not a single person ran in that cycle on any of those topics. But as soon as they got elected, these are the things they did. Yeah. When they never campaigned. But now it's time to, you know, call it for what it is. We got duped, voters got duped, and people are starting to feel the effects of these bad laws that went into a place. And I think the accountability is going to come in 2020.
And that is the hope. But Jesse, I appreciate you taking time. The forum was fantastic. I hope you guys will do another one between now and in the beginning of the caucuses and all of that. Because I think this is it's so important to have these issues out in front of people so that they can hear what the candidates have to say. But I appreciate the time.
And just in closing, I want to say one more thing, Rick, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention one campaign in Iowa, and that's the campaign of Congressman Steve King. And that guy is a national embarrassment who needs to go. And the Teamsters are going to help take him out. J.D. Scholten is a great candidate that's gonna beat Steve King next year. And you know, for too long, Steve King has been embarrassing this state. And I want to just assure people that a year from now, we won't have to worry about Steve King.
Good. You know, I used to look at him as just a chew toy, someone to put prop up as the worst of the Republican Party. But sadly, the Republican Party has caught up to him. So it'd be nice to see him out and a bunch of others come November. But Jesse, keep up the good work, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Seriously, you should check out the presidential forum. It was really very good. Because, look, they stuck to working class issues. That's what I think is important. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1953. That was the day that Ralph Cordiner, president of General Electric, issued his Cordiner Doctrine. It was the height of McCarthyism and the second Red Scare. The House Un-American Activities Committee persisted in its witch hunting of trade unionists, labor militants, and alleged communists. It targeted many of the unions purged from the CIO in 1949. The United Electrical Workers was one of those unions. The UE had organized the electrical manufacturing industry, including General Electric. Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy and HUAC each began investigating UE Local 301 at the General Electric plant in Schenectady, New York. GE didn't like the militancy of the UE or the bad publicity McCarthy generated about the company harboring subversives. So President Cordiner issued a memo which stated that any employee called before a Senate or legislative committee hearing who invoked the Fifth Amendment in response to inquiries regarding alleged communist ties shall be terminated. When McCarthy came to Albany, New York to hold hearings on alleged subversive activities 3 months later, hundreds of UE members packed the room, booing and jeering the senator and cheering the defendants. One African-American worker demanded, "Why don't you investigate subversion by GE of the Jim Crow system, of the profits taken from the sweat of my people?" McCarthy abruptly ended the hearings, but 28 UE members would be fired at General Electric. Other electrical manufacturers like Westinghouse soon followed suit. It was a devastating blow to the union and to the fired members who had helped build the UE from the ground up. But the union persevered and remains a powerful representative force for workers in the industry today. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I'll tell you, the presidential forum the Teamsters had over the weekend is, you know, really, really put into perspective for me. It is the moment that I decided that Bernie Sanders was the guy that I want to support in the primaries. I was on the fence. There are, a couple of people that I really liked. I like Elizabeth Warren. But I'll tell you, Sanders, his statement that, look, I've always been on the picket line. I've always stood up for working people. I've always done this. It's who I am. And the reality that there's no question that he's right. He's walked more picket lines than all of the field combined. No question about that. And the fact that, he also brought up the idea of ending at-will employment, which to me is one of those things that I've been saying for 15 years I've been doing this program. It's one of those things that union members don't even think about because, they're not at will. They've got a contract. And it's something that I don't think most union members understand how, maybe they do. Maybe I'm I'm overgeneralizing. But I don't think they realize, how important that is. In the workplace of knowing that you can't be fired for no reason whatsoever, or for some nonsensical reason. And you get people, and I get this from people all the time. Well, you can't fire union members. Yeah, you can. if they mess up, if they screw up, and you go through, you know, that thing that we like to believe in this country called due process, if you follow the rules and you document, you can fire union members. But absolutely, it happens all the time. But it has to be for cause. There has to be a reason. It isn't just, you know what, I don't like you today. Or, you know what, you wore a blue shirt. Or in the case, there was a case, I think it was Florida, where a bunch of office workers wore an orange shirt to show solidarity with each other or to be happy or whatever the hell it was. They fired them all. Fired all of them. And this is one of those moments where, you know, I thought of at the time, they all worked in a law office. All one of them had to say is, well, we were organizing a union and they'd had some protection. Concerted activity. But when Sanders talks like this, you know, I don't think most of the workforce understands, you know, just how bad at-will employment is. And, you know, I was reading an article by, I think it was one of the, you know, one of these right-wing think tank, you know, guys who, it's one of those things where you go, I never really thought I would find somebody to try and defend at-will employment, let alone call it an American norm. But we did find one, a guy from the Cato Institute, who is saying, look, if we do what Bernie Sanders wants, it's going to be horrible. Employers are never going to hire anybody. And I go, but hold on a second. I know a lot of people where at-will employment is not allowed. They have union contracts. And oddly enough, they still hire people. And it's one of these things that, you know, another guy says, you know, Sanders' goals are, you know, laudable. You know, we should give him credit for at least thinking, nice pat on the head. But they're misguided. You know, misguided that you should be able to have some say and some voice on the job. Misguided that you should have some security on the job. And, oh, hey, misguided in that maybe you should share in some of those profits. Misguided. No one would ever hire anyone again, which is laughable on its face. But it gets ink all over the place. And their argument is that, you know, basically if you end the at-will employment, there's going to be a disincentive for employers to hire people. And we're going to all go to these gig employees. And this is where you go, yeah, that's why you change the laws. That's why you have a comprehensive labor law reform that, you know, does away with at-will employment, does away with gig, you know, the independent contractor being misclassified, that does away with a lot of the things that corporate America has constructed. Just a thought. And it's one of these moments where, you know, in talking with union members who have these protections, and I argue take them for granted, should be going, you know, how do we make sure that everyone gets this? How do we make sure that we tell people what this is about? You know, I'm a believer in, you know, joining a union, being a member of a union is an incredible thing for your sanity, for your security. You're going to get, you know, not fired tomorrow for no reason. You're going to probably get really good health care. You're probably going to get some bit of a pension. You're going to get safer working conditions because we find study after study shows, you know, non-union workplaces much more dangerous. Why? Because you have these people working there who are afraid to say anything. Why? Because they're at will. What does that mean? That means you open your mouth, you're out the door. So what you have in these fiefdoms, where the boss being the king and all the peasants having to do the work, they're terrified of speaking out because they know, speak out, there's the door. So they put up with the dangerous working conditions, the lower wages, the more expensive health care, if any at all, crummy 401k, if anything at all. So for me, the idea that Sanders is going to go, you know what, we're going to move forward and we're going to do away with some of these horrible things is a good thing. It really is. It's a good thing. Giving people the ability to organize is a good thing. Why? Because it's going to raise the standard of living for folks. And we've seen this. We've lived this. My grandparents' generation built the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And you have a Republican Party and some conservative Democrats over the last 50 years who have torn that to shreds. Because we're right now back where my grandparents started off as children, with mass inequality, with a handful controlling the wealth that, you know, unimaginable kind of wealth. And you got somebody like Mike Bloomberg, and this is one of those things where you go, Mike, I think you really need to take a second and understand the crowd, because Mike Bloomberg's running for president, and he's kind of chafed by Warren and Sanders, pointing out that billionaires are taking more than their share, and that they're hoarding, and that they're not paying their share in taxes, and that the giant tax bill that Trump, the only accomplishment of this administration, actually benefited billionaires over the rest of us. Well, Bloomberg's a little ticked about that. And Bloomberg evidently was being interviewed by this Gayle King. And he said, it's my fault. It's not my fault that they didn't have the good sense to become billionaires. Talking about Warren and Sanders. It's not my fault that they didn't have the good sense to become a billionaire like me. He says, they've criticized me. Ask them what they're doing. Why didn't they do that? They had the chance to go out and make a lot of money. He says, I'm doing the same thing that they're doing, except I'm using my own money. And he's kind of tone deaf and doesn't quite understand that that's exactly what most of us don't want. We don't want kings. There was an article over the weekend that pointed out that Elizabeth Warren made $2 million in her legal years of arguing cases. What the headline didn't read, and again, going back to what I said at the beginning, that we read the headlines, maybe the first couple of lines, but don't actually read the rest of the article. What the rest of the article says is that was over 20 years. So the fact that she made $2 million over 20 years, I don't know that's a bad thing. I think that's a pretty good living, one that most of us should aspire, and one that a lot of us probably have. So to have someone like Bloomberg, say, wow, they could have been a billionaire like me. Not everybody wants to be a billionaire. But you should be able to eat. You should be able to have, clothing on your kids' back, a roof over their head, food on the table. And you should be able to do that through your work. And this is one of those moments where, you look at this and you just go, Bloomberg's way out of touch, really way out of touch. And I'm surprised why he wasn't at the Teamsters Forum. Tom Steyer was there. And in fact, I liked one of the things Steyer had to say. He said, look, my first organizing has been with organized labor. And my last will probably be with organized labor. Here's one of the billionaires saying, look, I get it. Now I don't want him to be president, but at least he's somewhere near the page. So it's just one of those things that's got my attention. And I guess this week I'm more focused on, since the Teamsters Forum, I'm more focused on union members not voting against their own best interests. Because I look at what this administration has done. You look at the fact that, their Supreme Court justices, overturned 40 years of decided law and made the entire country a right-to-work country for public sector workers in the Janus case. You look at the fact that the NLRB has made numerous changes to how they move cases forward and numerous changes on how the future of negotiating contracts and things will be done. And there's chaos coming in the world of organized labor because of the changes they've made. And it's not for the better. It's for the much worse, and it's going to get much uglier for union members in a second term of Trump. So when I see my friends who are handing out Teamsters for Trump shirts, scab shirts, I may add, I got to share this. So I go to work, and there's a guy handing out Teamsters for Trump shirts. And, I don't care because, you'd be a knucklehead if you have to. Whatever. Do what you got to do. And I wasn't going to say anything because I rarely do. Until I actually saw the shirt. Now, look, I'm a union guy. I'm not shy about that. I do look for the union label. I am an American-made guy. I think, you buy things made here in the country. But here's this printed on this T-shirt, Teamsters for Trump, on a shirt made in Haiti. So not even made in the U.S., let alone by union labor. And without a union bug. And I go, but you're a union person. You know, shouldn't you have at least one of the three at least be made in the U.S. if you're not going to have it union printed? Because for those who don't know, the union bug is that little insignia down at the bottom of the shirt or any printed material that has, you know, the union that printed it and the local number. So you know that it was done by union labor. It is. You go back to the 1970s, you know, look for the union label. There it is. It's the little bug down there. It's called the union bug. So I'm looking for the union bug, no union bug. And look, I don't think a union printer would print on a T-shirt made overseas anyway. So I know you've got the trifecta of anti-union nonsense. You've got not made in the U.S., not made by union labor, and not printed by union labor. So why would you slap a union name on that? So when I call it a scab shirt, that's what it is. It doesn't matter to me what's on it. It matters to me that you're handing this off as a union item with a union's name on it, and it's against everything that unions stand for. That's the part that grabbed me. So when I asked the guy how much the scab shirts for Trump cost, he goes off on this screaming rant about liberal BS. And I didn't even get he didn't even tell me how much they were. So I'm like, you know, I guess just asking a question is not liberal, and I'm okay with that because I ask a lot of questions. And then he got into his big, you know, souped up truck and sped off like he was really angry, which again, you know, gave me a chuckle. But it made me think that, you know, there are so many people out there who, especially in this election cycle, are voting against their own best interest for whatever the reason is. I don't know if he's a homophobe. I don't know if he's a racist. I don't know if he's just plain stupid. I don't know. Because you can't engage in a conversation of, hey, you know, what made you do this? What made you put the flag in the ground and say, yep, I'm supporting the guy who is seriously going to harm my employment? Who is doing everything they can possibly do to ensure that I don't get a raise. Now, understand, this guy and others like them will be the first ones to complain next contract when they don't get a raise or the raise isn't significant or the healthcare benefits don't get better. Maybe they get a little worse. Or you have to give something up. They're going to be the first ones to whine. And you go, but hold on. You're the nitwit who voted for the guy who weakened the union's ability to fight for those better wages, hours, and conditions. And now you're going to turn around and now you're going to say something? Now you're going to complain? And this is, again, the problem that I have with a lot of the knee-jerk stuff that's going on where you can't actually have a conversation. Because if I were able to talk to this person, I'd say, look, do you know what this administration has done? Set Janus aside. Set the Janus decision at the Supreme Court aside that created right to work for the entire country for public sector workers. Never mind that. Let's even let that go. The fact that the NLRB is changing a massive change on how decertification is done in this country should alarm every union member who's under a contract. Under the old rules, if a company believed that the union didn't enjoy majority support, there had to be a decertification petition circulated. You had to get 30% of the people to sign on to it to trigger an election. That's how it used to be. Now all that has to happen is the employer, and this is the regulatory change that the administration has made through the NLRB, now all they have to do is claim, we don't think the union has majority support. They have to make that claim 90 days before the expiration of a contract, and the union has 45 days to schedule a new election without actually knowing what the employees want. So what does this mean? This means that the unions are going to spend most of their time, energy, and resource continually running organizing campaigns against companies with very deep pockets. And even if the companies lose the election, they win by weakening the union's ability to fight and enforce those contracts. This is a really bad thing. This is horrible for union members. And it's bad for all workers because understand, when you have a higher union density, you generally have a higher wage and it pulls everybody up, even the people who aren't anywhere near being a union member. And this is what's happened over the last 40 years. As union density has dropped, wages have stagnated, and in many industries, actually gone down. This isn't rocket science. You don't need to be a genius to figure it out. This is pretty simple stuff. If you don't have the power, you don't have the manpower or woman power, you don't have the ability to demand better, you don't get better. Sorry, there aren't many benevolent employers who just bestow wonderful things upon you. You have to fight for them. And we're at a time right now where this administration, Donald Trump and the Republican wish machine, they are getting everything that they wanted. That all these think tanks have been dreaming up, the American Legislative Exchange Council's been trying to ram through, and they're doing it through executive order. They're doing it through regulatory changes and deregulation, you know, because of those job-killing regulations that every knuckleheaded conservative loves to spew out, but yet can't point to one to me. So again, you go back and you go, what has this administration done for working people? Did you get any of the tax cut? No. In fact, being in the trucking industry, truck drivers really got screwed. Because as my conversation with my Tea Party dentist today went, I said, look, the only thing the Trump administration has gotten passed legislatively through is that tax heist, where they handed away almost $2 trillion to the 1% of this country. Most of us didn't get anything. And he said, my Tea Party dentist said, well, you know, small businesses seem to like it. And I said, really? I go, well, how much are you paying more in taxes? He goes, well, yeah, I'm paying higher taxes because of it. But it's simpler. And I'm going, hold on. So if Obama would have raised your taxes and made it simpler, you'd have been okay with it. And he thought, and he said, well, no. And this is one of those moments where you go, so you're paying more and not complaining, but you would have before. Because again, I've yet to find anybody. I really want to. Please, somebody, if you did better, if you are paying less taxes and you're a working person, I want to know it. Because the majority of us are not. And again, back to the truck drivers. One of the things that the Trump tax plan did is it eliminated the ability of union members to deduct their union dues, which you'd always been able to do. So you're paying higher taxes because of that. It eliminated your ability to deduct work-related stuff like gloves and shirts and jeans and reflective gear and, you know, all the safety stuff that you need. All that's done. It's done away with deductions that you would take on the road. Again, you know, huge amounts of money being lost, thousands of dollars. And yet, we don't hear where the Tea Party people screaming about this. Most working people are paying higher taxes. But yet, the folks with the scab shirts for Trump are just all because they're ticking off a liberal. And I said, you're not ticking me off. You're the one you're losing. And I used to not care that dumb people did dumb things that did irreparable harm to themselves, until I realized that by allowing stupid to do dumb stuff that harms him, ultimately harms me and everybody else. And that's why I'm passionate about bringing up the fact that you've got these knuckleheads who do this stuff if for no other reason than to get attention. Don't know if they were dropped on their head at birth or what, but it's all about getting attention. Well, he's got my attention now. Scab shirts for Trump have my attention. And it's angering to no end. Because again, it's picking, it's doing us harm. It's tearing us apart. And that's the one thing that Trump and ultimately the Russian troll farms and Putin and the rest of them want. They want a divided America. They want a country that it's at each other's throat. They want a country that's not talking about issues and how to move us forward and make life better. They want us at each other's throat, denying and dividing each other. And they're winning. Truth of the matter is, they're winning. Because they're doing a masterful job of it. So the question becomes, how do we as a country, how do we as a working class, how do we ensure that we don't let them win? How do we turn back the propaganda? How do we at every turn when you see the person forwarding the meme or the chain email or any of that stuff, how do you push back? Because at some point it has to happen, doesn't it? Truth, we like to believe, prevails, right? We like to believe that truth will overtake misinformation. Truth will overtake dishonesty. We like to believe that, right? To me, that's what this, you want to talk about this being an important election? This is an important election because truth matters. That simple. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We might expect that corporate billionaires and Coke funds